KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump promised an announcement about Israel annexing Palestinian areas. What are people in the West Bank thinking as a president muses about their future? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. How is the U.S. competing for influence as the administration tries to shut down a foreign aid agency? I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A Republican who once ran USAID asserts, quote, "We just lost the battle, so what's the next move?" Who enforces a court order if a president defies it? And this isn't the first time things got awkward between the U.S. and Denmark over Greenland. It's Thursday, February 6th. In 1952, England's King George died and was succeeded by Queen Elizabeth, who reigned long enough to produce material for six seasons of The Crown. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. There are just hours remaining for federal workers to decide whether to take the Trump administration's offer to resign from their jobs now and keep their pay and benefits through September 30th, despite agencies only being funded through mid-March. As NPR's Andrea Hsu reports, a federal court in Boston is weighing a request for a stay.
U.S. District Judge George O'Toole, who's a Clinton appointee, will preside over a hearing scheduled for 1 p.m. Eastern Time. The lawsuit was brought by unions representing more than 800,000 civil servants. It alleges that the deferred resignation offer is arbitrary and capricious, as well as unlawful. The unions argue that the offer fails to consider possible adverse consequences to the government's ability to function and is pretext for removing and replacing workers on an ideological basis. The offer went out to more than 2 million civilian employees of the federal government, including this week to members of the National Security Agency and the CIA. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
President Trump's plan to, quote, own Gaza and relocate its population, some 2 million people, to other countries, is drawing criticism from many countries, including Egypt and Jordan, who say they won't take in Gaza's war refugees. Secretary of State Marco Rubio yesterday doubled down on the plan, suggesting Palestinians would have no choice but to move.
The only thing President Trump has done very generously, in my view, is offer the United States willingness to step in, clear the debris, clean the place up from all the destruction that's on the ground, clean it up of all these unexploded munitions.
Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will be on Capitol Hill today to meet with Republican Senate and House leadership. Stocks opened higher this morning as the Labor Department delivered a report card on workers' productivity. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
U.S. workers got a little more productive in the final months of 2024, churning out 1.2% more goods and services with every hour of work. That's important because when workers are more productive, they can earn higher wages without putting upward pressure on prices. New applications for unemployment benefits inched up last week as 219,000 people applied for jobless aid. We'll get a more complete snapshot of the job market tomorrow when the Labor Department reports on employment gains for the month of January. The generally solid job market has given the Federal Reserve leeway to hold interest rates steady after three rate cuts last fall. Today, the Bank of England lowered its benchmark interest rate for the third time in 6 months. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow has reversed gains, earlier gains. Today, it's now trading flat at 44,873. The NASDAQ is up 18 points. The S&P 500 is up by 8 points. For the S&P 500, that's up about 0.1%. You're listening to NPR News. In his first administration, President Trump railed at his political foes for what he called a merciless campaign to erase history with the removal of Confederate monuments. At the National Prayer Breakfast this morning, he said he's establishing a new national park.
I have signed an executive order to resume the process of creating a new national park full of statues of the greatest Americans who ever lived. We're going to be honoring our heroes, honoring the greatest people.
Though he didn't give any indication of where it would be or who would be in it. A UCLA report finds the Los Angeles area wildfires have caused between $95 and $164 billion in total property and capital losses. CAP Radio's Manola Sakaida has more.
So far, the Eaton and Palisades fires have resulted in the loss of over 16,000 homes and other structures. Ju-Yin Lee is an economist with UCLA's Anderson School of Management and a co-author of the report. She says this could be California's most expensive series of wildfires to date, in large part because of where they happened.
We see that the median home price in these two recent fires is much higher than previous ones. That may cause like more loss.
She says the damage could also cause a loss of $4.6 billion for Los Angeles County's GDP for 2025. For NPR News, I'm Manola Sakaita in Sacramento.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 28 points, the Nasdaq up 16, S&P 500 up 8. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Coming up, one company's recovery after the Lahaina wildfire in Hawaii.
First, we'll hear what some Palestinians think about the President of the United States who spoke about their future.
President Trump surprised allies and enemies alike this week when he called for the United States to take over Gaza. He said he wanted to relocate the nearly 2 million people there. Trump also promised some kind of announcement about another big Palestinian zone, the West Bank.
Which is where we found NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in the city of Ramallah. Welcome back.
Hey, good morning.
What are you hearing on the West Bank?
Yeah, so a lot of people, when I asked them about Trump's comments, started kind of smirking and basically saying, you know, I'll believe it when I see it. But a few people I talked to did admit that Gaza is in ruins, people there don't have proper living conditions, and that something needs to be done. Here's Ahmed Habib. He's a pharmacist in Ramallah, but he's originally from Gaza. He still has a lot of family there. He told me, all I care about is if people there have food, have milk, he says. People in Gaza deserve to live. I don't care where Trump wants to put us, if they can just have a good life. But other Palestinians out here I talk to point out that Gaza is Palestinian land, and that even if they think Trump's plan is not realistic, talk of moving people from that land is very emotional and unsettling.
And of course, the conflict over the land is central to the area where you are. You're outside of Gaza. You're in a much larger land area, the West Bank. You have millions of Palestinians there. You have Israelis who have founded settlements there and taken control of large parts of the West Bank. So what are people thinking, and what is actually going on the ground in the West Bank?
Yeah, I mean, you have to remember that the backdrop to all of this right now is that the Israeli military is still conducting a very big operation through many of the cities in the northern part of the West Bank. Israel launched this operation just 2 days after the ceasefire in Gaza went into effect, and they've said that this one is different from past operations. For example, Defense Minister Israel Katz announced that Israeli troops are going to remain in the Jenin refugee camp. That's the epicenter of the fighting. This hasn't happened before. It'd be a big shift in Israeli policy. For months, Palestinians Palestinians in the West Bank that I've been talking to here have told me that they've been worried that Israel's military focus might soon be moving from Gaza to them, and ultimately that Israel might try to take more land here.
Well, let's talk about that, because Trump mentioned the West Bank as well when he dropped this surprise proposal for the United States to own Gaza, which the administration has walked back to some extent since. He also said that in the next few weeks, he'd be saying something about the West Bank. People must be wondering what that something is going to be.
Yeah, last night I met Adil Abu Majd. He's a chef in Ramallah. He's originally from Jenin, where the Israeli military is focused right now. He left a couple months ago. And he told me he's paying close attention to what Trump is saying.
He
said what Trump said about Gaza empowers Israel to do whatever they want, to take the land that they want. And he thinks annexation could be a real possibility here in the West Bank. You know, after Trump was elected last November, several far-right Israeli ministers commented that this might now be the time for Israel to move on West Bank annexation. You know, I should point out that all of this would be illegal under international law. But Trump also appointed key people in his administration who have said that they would support Israeli annexation. So given Trump's Gaza statements and his planned announcement about the West Bank in the future, all of this has people here pretty nervous.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in the occupied West Bank. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Since that helicopter collided last week with an American Airlines flight over Washington, D.C., Trump administration officials have raised concerns over America's air traffic control system. Now, without linking it to the cause of the crash, the new Secretary of Transportation, Sean Duffy, called it antiquated. Here he is Sunday on Fox News.
A lot of the technology dates back to World War II. We developed the best technology in this country, but we don't implement it here.
With us is Margaret Wallace. She teaches air traffic control and airport management at the Florida Institute of Technology. So, Margaret, let's start by just putting all this into perspective. How many flights does the air traffic control system have to keep up with?
Well, there are about 10 million scheduled passenger flights every year.
10 million scheduled. Oh, that's a heck of a lot of flights to keep up with.
Yes, and that's just passenger. That doesn't include cargo or regular civilian traffic.
Now, there are multiple systems that monitor air traffic. What are some of the oldest parts?
The oldest part is probably our primary radar system. That's what Sean Duffy was talking about. That radar does date back to World War II.
And how effective is it? I mean, if it's so old, that's a long time ago that we're talking about, and it's relying on it to keep up with modern day aircraft.
Very true. Very true. It basically sends out radio waves, and if it hits a object, it sends back a signal, and that's the only information you get from that particular type of radar. Now, we do have additional radar systems, things that work off the transponder on the aircraft, so it's more of a digital system. But we are well behind compared to other countries.
So why hasn't the U.S. found a way to either quickly or slowly implement newer things?
Well, they have started a program called NextGen, which started maybe 30 years ago. And it has brought some new systems in, for instance, GPS tracking, which gives us more real-time data as to where aircraft are and their altitudes and things like that. So we have done some improvements. We're just a little slow to implement it. It requires government funding, but due to bureaucracies and the powers that be, we're just not at the same pace as some of the other countries like Eurocontrol and Canada and China.
Are other places using things like artificial intelligence to help?
There are some that are moving into that, particularly China, Canada. They are moving into AI systems, which could help controllers with predicting possible events at an earlier stage than what they currently have the ability to do.
And is that something that the U.S. could actually integrate, short of doing a whole overhaul?
I mean, I see why not. We've got the technology. We use it in other programs, SpaceX, things like that. I don't see why we couldn't use it in air traffic.
So, Margaret, what kind of training does it take to be part of an air traffic control system?
As far as the air traffic control side, it takes 2 to 5 years for an air traffic controller to become a certified controller. And that technology and using the technology, maintaining it, is all incorporated in that 2 to 5 years.
Considering that, you know, the equipment, some of the equipment that's being used dates back to World War II, how confident should people feel about flying in the United States?
It is still the safest form of travel. I know there's been recent circumstances that may concern people, but you're more likely to have an incident in a car than you are in an aircraft. So what we call an acceptable risk.
That's Margaret Wallace. She teaches air traffic control and airport management at the Florida Institute of Technology. Margaret, thanks.
Thank you.
It's nearing peak whale watching season in Hawaii. December through March is when humpback whales migrate thousands of miles to waters around Hawaii to mate and give birth.
On the island of Maui, boats dart across the water every day. One of them is captained by Emma Nelson.
I've been captaining for almost 5 years, and I've been out here for almost 10.
Nelson works for a company in Lahaina called Maui Ocean Adventures. It was started by Nelson's wife, Chrissy Lovett, in 2023, but this is actually the company's first season on the water.
Yeah, that's because just 2 weeks after they opened for business, the deadly wildfire tore through Lahaina. Captain Nelson says their entire workshop, all their vehicles, and three boats burned up.
I would say boats alone were over $700,000 replacement value. And like a lot of people, we were underinsured because no one expected the harbor to burn down.
In all, Lahaina suffered more than $5 billion in damage. The wildfires killed more than 100 people.
Here's the company owner, Chrissy Lovett.
There's the sadness, there's the grief, there's the anger, there's the frustration, but I'm seeing people move forward.
Last November, Lovett and Nelson saved up enough to buy their first replacement boat. And with help from volunteers, Lovett says they were able to get it ready by the start of the whale watching season, which was in December.
Thing is, though, Lovett says they're still in a lot of debt from building up their business and then having to rebuild it.
When you just built a business from scratch, it's exhausting.
While Lovett doesn't expect them to be in the black anytime soon, they want to share what they do have.
We save seats every single trip for the fire survivors to help with their healing and their trauma. I was traumatized after that experience. I didn't want to get back on a boat, and I've been a boat captain for 25 years. And just being on a boat, being with the wildlife, I found that it was definitely like healing.
Lovett says they've given away almost 200 free seats to fire survivors since December.
It's more fulfilling than any amount of money in the world.
And this season of whale watching is going better than expected. They're even seeing baby humpback whales.
It's a baby.
Oh, it's a holy baby.
Adorbs, the newest members of a species whose numbers have rebounded in the last decades.
Apparently, comebacks are possible.
Oh, you guys, coming super close right here.
Yeah, look at
whoa.
Look at that water.
Look at this.
Thanks for listening to Your Public Radio Station, which brings you Morning Edition. We know you get information from a lot of sources, and our commitment, what makes NPR different, is we're trying to bring you reliable information. And show it. Prove what we say. Challenge officials to prove what they say, and give you the context to understand if they don't. We also commit to coming back tomorrow to keep trying, because the world is a complicated place. You never learned it all at once. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, writer and dominatrix Brittany Newell joins us to talk about her new novel, Softcore. It explores the underworld of San Francisco's dive bars, strip clubs, and BDSM dungeons, where tech bros, executives, and outcasts live out their fantasies. Join us. Shiny,
shiny, shiny boots of leather. Support for NPR comes from the station and from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, whose scientists work to lay the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, which are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. DanaFarber.org/everywhere. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Federal courts are weighing legal challenges to many of President Trump's recent executive orders. In some cases, the judges have ruled against him, which got us wondering who enforces a judicial ruling against the president. So we called up Tara Grove. She teaches law at the University of Texas, Austin, with a focus on the constitutional separation of powers. Tara, so anything in the Constitution about a scenario where the president refuses to obey a judge's order?
So the Constitution does give the federal courts the judicial power, which some people say means people have to abide by their orders. And federal judges can give increasingly intense, enthusiastic orders. But at the end of the day, the really important thing is that presidents have complied with federal court orders. One example is the Nixon administration. So as some may remember, there was a big fight over the tapes related to the Watergate scandal. This went to court. During the litigation, President Nixon's lawyers indicated that they might not abide by a Supreme Court decision that said you have to turn over the tapes. During the oral argument, President Nixon's attorney suggested that President Nixon might not abide by that order. At the time, Justice Thurgood Marshall did not take kindly to that suggestion. When the Supreme Court ultimately did issue its decision, President Nixon did comply, and one important thing to know about that history is that members of Congress, including members of Congress in President Nixon's own party, made it quite clear that he would be impeached if he failed to comply with the Supreme Court's decision. President Nixon complied. Now, as it turned out, that the release of the tapes did, in fact, destroy the Nixon administration, and President Nixon resigned 2 weeks after the decision. But this is an example where everyone came together and said the president must comply with judicial decisions.
So it sounds like it requires some measure of solidarity then.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, earlier this week, we had Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut on the show, and he told my colleague Michelle Martin that President Trump's attempts to expand presidential power have put the country in a constitutional crisis. Let's listen to that for a second.
The president of the United States does not have the power unilaterally to suspend all federal programs. He certainly does not have the power to suspend those programs and then decide on his own which entities get money and which don't.
Tara, do you believe that line has been crossed here?
So far, federal courts have said that it is not lawful to suspend all programs. And there's been some concern about whether folks have complied with that. It's quite possible that executive officials just haven't quite figured out how to get the money out again. There's always the charitable reading of how the executive officials are acting. So I think we're in a very uncertain period right now. It's only been a matter of days since we've had both the declaration of no spending and then the federal court order following up and saying, actually, many of these funds have to go out.
How does the Supreme Court's ruling on presidential immunity factor into all of this, if it does?
So the recent ruling was really just about criminal liability for the president, and the Supreme Court declared that it is very, very difficult, not impossible, but very, very difficult to hold the president liable, accountable for criminal violations. Presidents have had immunity from actions within the outer perimeter of their office from civil suits for a very long time. That actually comes from another case involving President Nixon, Nixon versus Fitzgerald. So that kind of presidential immunity has been around for a long time.
So it sounds like we're in a kind of a whole new world. Everyone's paying attention to how it's all going to play out.
It sure feels that way.
Yeah. Tara Grove is the Vinson and Elkins Chair in Law at the University of Texas, Austin. Tara, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
President Trump's administration is trying many things all at once, and here's how we have thought about this at Morning Edition. We want to keep you informed rather than overwhelmed, so we are following stories carefully over time, coming back to them, reporting more as we learn more. And that includes this recent news item, which seems many days old, but it's just a few days old. FBI employees who handled January 6 cases have sued their bosses at the Justice Department. They want to prevent the department from releasing their names and firing them. NPR's Kerry Johnson reports on a new group that is taking the employees' side.
Stacey Young spent 18 years as a career lawyer at the DOJ before she departed last month.
My colleagues right now are terrified.
Young sees a deliberate campaign to traumatize federal workers and prevent them from doing their jobs.
Many DOJ employees came to me and said, there's nobody out there who's helping us. We need help.
Now Young wants people to know help is on the way. She's launched a new group called Justice Connection. Young's already connected dozens of DOJ employees with lawyers, recruited hundreds of alumni to provide advice, and started to set up a mental health support network.
They are dedicated. They are apolitical. They are the backbone of the department.
People all over the Justice Department are reeling from slash-and-burn-style personnel actions over the last 2 weeks. First, Trump administration officials in charge during early days at the DOJ fired the prosecutors who investigated Trump. Then they reassigned career civil servants with decades of experience in national security, civil rights, and the environment to work on immigration.
It was quite a warning shot. Everybody in almost every position at DOJ is worried that they could be next.
DOJ said some of the lawyers it fired could not be trusted to carry out Trump's agenda, and no FBI agents would lose their jobs for following orders. There's a long process for terminating career employees, and lawyers who work with federal workers say the DOJ does not seem to have followed it. Here's employment lawyer Kevin Owen.
Fire the employees, make them sue, and if the employees win, then they'll get paid out on the taxpayer's dime. And while they're off the rolls, the administration gets what they want, which is not having these employees there to do the jobs that they have been hired and trained for years to do.
As for Stacey Young, her new group is still in early days, but she's heard from so many workers at other federal agencies that she's considering replicating her model across the federal government. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
President Trump has laid out a plan for the Gaza Strip, asserting that the U.S. will take ownership of the territory, but Gaza's police force is still active.
They are in every roundabout, in every junction.
What this means for the future of the Gaza Strip and the Palestinians who live there, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Israel's defense minister is advising the country's military to prepare to implement President Trump's plan to relocate Palestinians from Gaza. Earlier this week, Trump suggested the U.S. take over Gaza and have countries such as Egypt and Jordan take in Palestinians. NPR's Jerome Sokolowski reports from Tel Aviv.
Defense Minister Israel Katz says the military should prepare exit options by land, sea, and air so that anyone who wishes to can leave for, quote, any country willing to accept them. He says Spain, Norway, Ireland, and other countries that have criticized Israel's actions during its war against Hamas should take them in. Quote, their hypocrisy will be exposed if they refuse to do so, Katz said in a statement. Spain's foreign minister, José Manuel Álvarez, responded on Spanish national radio. Spain makes its own decisions. No third party should tell it what to do. Álvarez added that Gaza must be part of a future Palestinian state. Jerome Sokolovsky, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was on Capitol Hill this morning. He's got a meeting scheduled with Senate Majority Leader John Thune. This afternoon, Netanyahu is supposed to meet with House Speaker Mike Johnson. This is NPR News. More than 40,000 federal employees have said yes to the Trump administration's offer of deferred resignation. That's about 2% of the workforce. Today's the deadline for federal employees to decide. Those who take the offer will get paid through September, though legal challenges are still pending. NPR's Rachel Treisman says Elon Musk's involvement with the Trump administration's effort to slash federal spending is reminding people of when the billionaire bought Twitter, now known as X.
Trump administration special employee Elon Musk sent Twitter employees a similar fork in the road offer shortly after taking over the company in late 2022. A biography of Musk reveals that about 30% of the workforce accepted, but many more quit or were laid off around the same time. Here's labor lawyer Shannon Liss Reardon.
It's been very eerie watching what's been happening over the last week, where he rolls out the same Twitter playbook now with the federal government, and he couldn't even come up with a new subject line for the email.
Liss Reardon is representing thousands of former Twitter employees who are suing the company because they received less severance than was promised. She worries federal workers could end up in a similar position. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
Stocks on Wall Street are mixed this morning. The Dow is down 75 points. The S&P is up 8. The Nasdaq is up 27 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. From Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Let's get a picture of what the United States is no longer doing as the administration tries to shut down a foreign aid agency.
Yeah, the Trump administration has put most of the agency's global workforce on administrative leave and frozen the majority of its budget. Elon Musk claimed without evidence that the U.S. Agency for International Development is corrupt or criminal. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says he wants to make sure the work aligns with the national interest. Now, until recent days, the U.S. was the largest donor of foreign aid in the world.
NPR's Gabrielle Emanuel covers global health and has some facts to put all this in context. Good morning.
Hi.
Okay, so when we say the U.S. has been the largest donor of foreign aid, how much are we talking about?
If you look at 2023, total foreign assistance was $66 billion. It reached a lot of people, but it represented less than 1% of the U.S. budget.
Okay, so we certainly spend more on other things, but it's $66 billion, which is a lot for foreign aid. What did that mean for certain places like, say, Ukraine, where the United States has paid so much attention?
Ukraine is among the top recipients of U.S. aid. It goes to things like rebuilding infrastructure after it's attacked by Russia, or seeds and fertilizer to build up the agriculture sector to get more exports. The Trump administration has issued some narrow waivers, but most things have stopped. For example, NPR's Ukraine Bureau has confirmed disruptions in the delivery of HIV/AIDS medications.
And I want to figure out where the U.S. interest lies. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has said, listen, I want foreign aid to be in the U.S. national interest and not charity. At the same time, Rubio acknowledged sometimes foreign aid is in the U.S. national interest. So why does the United States traditionally provide this type of assistance?
Part of the thinking is helping people creates goodwill, and it gives the U.S. greater influence in the world by stabilizing countries so they don't turn to America's adversaries for support. I spoke with Andrew Natsios. He's the former director of USAID under President George W. Bush, a self-described conservative Republican. He says halting foreign aid is happening at a precarious moment as the U.S. competes with Russia, China, Iran for influence.
We just lost the battle. It's not because we were fighting and we lost. We took our troops and we went home. That's what we did.
Now, he agrees with Trump that government spending is at crisis levels, and he does not think every foreign aid program is perfect. But he says cutting all of USAID is cutting muscle, not fat.
I suppose we should pause to say that there are members of Congress who assert that all of this is illegal. Congress has devoted the funding to USAID and created this agency and that its work is supposed to go ahead. But we are told that everybody at USAID has been told to come home. So how's this playing out on the ground?
Well, U.S. assistance goes to a lot of things, but particularly health, helping control disease outbreaks, for example. So if we look at Uganda, it is dealing with an Ebola outbreak right now. The World Health Organization told me typically the U.S. would be funding technical support, like transportation of highly contagious Ebola samples and screening at airports to make sure no one is carrying the virus across borders. But this time, that U.S. funding has stopped.
Ah, trying to make sure it doesn't cross borders, and you can see the U.S. national interest there, I suppose. NPR's Gabrielle Emmanuel covers global health. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
President Trump's talk of buying or seizing the Danish territory of Greenland has raised tensions with that ally and fellow NATO member. Jay Price of member station WUNC reports on an earlier chapter in the long geopolitical tangle there between the U.S. and Denmark.
On the top of the world, below the surface of a giant ice cap, a city is buried.
Well, maybe not a city. The Army promotional tape is a little enthusiastic, but there was an experimental military base hidden under the ice and powered by one of the first portable nuclear reactors.
In this remote setting, less than 800 miles from the North Pole, Camp Century is a symbol of man's unceasing struggle to conquer his environment.
And now kind of a symbol of taking advantage of an ally. When construction started on the base, the United States hadn't asked Denmark for permission, something required by treaty. It was 1959, the Cold War was raging, and the U.S. Army had decided to test the idea of hiding bases from Soviet view under the ice.
There was a main street, main tunnel, if you will, and off to that were tunnels to the left and right. Mess hall, there were sleeping quarters.
In the early 1960s, John Fresh was a young soldier assigned to photograph Army experiments in the Arctic. Twice he made the three-day overland trip from his small base on the coast to Camp Century and stayed in the prefabricated buildings there, buried in more than 2 miles of tunnels. There was a clinic, library, even a theater.
We had everything you could imagine, lights and heat and all that kind of stuff. It was cold. I mean, you know, when you walk down there, you could feel it's, you know, like walking into a freezer.
The Army video makes it sound like an adventure, but a tour of duty at Camp Century was cold, wet, and often boring. On the surface, conditions could be extreme. That far north, it's dark 24 hours a day for months in the winter. Temperatures can fall to minus 70, and winds have been clocked at well over 125 miles an hour. under the ice, things weren't great either. The tops and sides of the tunnels needed constant trimming with chainsaws as the ice continually pressed inward, threatening to crush the camp. Dozens of tons a week had to be removed.
Someone miscalculated. They said, well, we were built in a place where the ice cap isn't really moving. Well, that was wrong.
After just a couple of years, the Army decided the tunnels were too hard to maintain. The camp was abandoned, and its buildings were crushed by the ice and buried deeper and deeper. Recent NASA measurements found the remnants are now about 100 feet below the surface. A dark secret side of Camp Century might have been buried along with it, but for an unrelated incident a couple of years later.
There was a lot of deception going on and also a lot of hidden agendas.
Christian Nielsen teaches science history at Aarhus University in Denmark. A 1968 crash of a U.S. jet with nuclear bombs aboard eventually led to an investigation of past American behavior in Greenland. It found that a Danish prime minister had secretly approved the presence of U.S. nuclear weapons, and what's more, that the United States had planned on putting some under the ice, a lot of them.
We know a lot about Camp Century, but we don't know so much about Project Iceworm.
Project Iceworm, out of view of the Soviets, ready to pop up anywhere. The plan was to place 600 nuclear missiles under the ice, along with 11,000 troops and rail networks to move the missiles through thousands of miles of tunnels.
I mean, we only have secondary material describing the project, so I think there's still a lot of things to be uncovered.
And these days, Denmark has fresh worries about its much larger ally. An ally that hasn't always been straightforward about its plans. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Durham, North Carolina.
This is NPR News.
Anthony Scaramucci spent 11 days as spokesman in the first Trump White House and was then pushed out. We'll ask him about a busy second term next time here and now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Merriam-Webster released their slang dictionary, which is high-key eating, or really good. They're keeping language on fleek, or amazing, and vibing with the times by adding new terms. It's got riz, or charisma, pulling the freshest words that hit differently in pop culture. Whether you're looking for a term that's low-key fire or the goat, this dictionary will have it, giving you the lingo you need to have main character energy, no cap.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. An experimental treatment that stimulates the spinal cord may help people with a paralyzing genetic disorder. NPR's John Hamilton reports on a study of three people with a rare inherited condition.
Doug McCullough was 11 when he was diagnosed with spinal muscular atrophy, or SMA, a disorder that kills off motor neurons in the spinal cord. McCullough is in his 50s now and relies on two canes or a wheelchair to get around.
As a person with a progressive disease, you never get any better. You're either maintaining or you're getting worse.
So McCullough had low expectations when he signed up for a four-week experiment at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Scientists there temporarily implanted wires in his spine. Then, in the lab, they began delivering pulses of electricity to certain nerves.
That first afternoon, they were like, do you feel anything? You're like, no. And then they'd start turning it up a little bit, and then you'd start feeling this faint pulse inside your body.
Specifically, in his legs. And over the course of the experiment, McCullough's legs regained some function. He could walk farther, his gait was better, his legs felt stronger even when the spinal stimulator wasn't connected.
And after some days, my legs just felt supercharged. It's like, man, I feel like I can walk a mile.
Two other volunteers with SMA also improved. The youngest was 20, says Marco Cabagrosso, one of the scientists in charge of the experiment.
He improved so much he could walk from the family housing where they were staying for the trial to our lab, and he couldn't do that before.
There are now drugs that can slow or stop the loss of motor neurons in people with SMA, but the treatment doesn't restore the muscle function they've lost. Capogrosso's team had been using spinal stimulation to boost arm strength in stroke patients and thought the approach might work on the leg muscles in people with SMA. In both cases, the idea was to get more out of the relatively small number of nerve cells that remain intact. Capogrosso says the results with SMA patients were remarkable.
Friday, they would come in the lab, do their tests, and then they would go home. Then on Monday, they would be back. We would reassess their strength because they were doing it on a daily basis. And suddenly, they had 20% more strength for the knee extension.
Much of the improvement was maintained even when the stimulator wasn't turned on. Capogrosso thinks that's because stimulation had helped reestablish communication between the remaining motor neurons and other neurons involved in the circuit that allows walking.
They had much less motor neurons left because some of those died, but now they were starting working as normal motor neurons. So this increase in strength that we observed was because their cells were better able at controlling their muscle.
The result, which appears in the journal Nature Medicine, supports an idea proposed in 2011 by George Mentis at Columbia University.
What people thought until that time is that this is really a motor neuron disease. And if you fix the motor neurons, you will be fixing the disease.
But Mentis showed that in mice with SMA, the disease also disrupts connections between motor neurons, which tell a muscle when to contract, and sensory neurons, which monitor what that muscle is doing. Mentis says the results in Pittsburgh suggest that spinal stimulation improves these connections and could make a big difference to people with SMA.
During that month of electrical stimulation, we never reached a plateau. They were still improving. So obviously you will say to me, oh my God, can they improve anymore? The preliminary data says yes.
Mentis says spinal stimulation also might help people with other diseases that affect movement, including ALS and Parkinson's. John Hamilton, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez.
Which interest rates affect us the most?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Glassdoor. Adam Grant has joined the Glassdoor community with expert advice on finding a job and making the most of work life, all on the Glassdoor app. And by Bitwarden Password Manager, designed to help millions of users create strong, unique passwords across all devices and accounts during Data Privacy Week and beyond. Available at bitwarden.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. The new Secretary of Treasury, Scott Bessent, says when it comes to interest rates, he's less worried about what the Federal Reserve will do and more focused on one particular number, the 10-year Treasury yield. Some explanation is required. Here's Marketplace's Nova Safo.
The Federal Reserve sets short-term rates, which ripple throughout the economy, but a whole host of factors can influence another key number, the 10-year Treasury yield, which itself affects consumer borrowing costs. In an interview on Fox Business, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said he and President Trump are focused on lowering that number.
We cut the spending, that we cut the size of government, we get more efficiency in government, and we're going to go into a good interest rate cycle.
Selling less government debt could lower the interest rates the government has to offer for that debt. The Treasury Department could also change the mix of its debt offerings, something Bessent accused his predecessor of doing, which Janet Yellen denied. Investors also send yields higher or lower based on where they think inflation is headed. And tariff policies have complicated that picture. I'm Nova Salfa for Marketplace.
That 10-year interest rate, that yield, is up slightly at 4.43% now. Stocks, the Dow is down 0.2%, 108 points. The S&P and the NASDAQ are both up just slightly. As of tomorrow, the Trump administration is putting almost all employees of the U.S. Agency for International Development on leave. A rally on Capitol Hill yesterday as part of an emerging pushback. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer was there.
USAID supporters at the rally held signs saying things like USAID saves lives and save USAID. They chanted
USA! USA!
Heard speeches from members of Congress and worried about USAID's unfinished work. Atul Gawande was USAID Assistant Administrator for Global Health in the Biden administration. He says the skeleton crew left at USAID isn't funding even the humanitarian aid Secretary of State Marco Rubio exempted from the Trump administration's freeze. Gawande only knows of one aid project that's actually been funded to help stem an Ebola outbreak in Uganda. But he says staff on the ground aren't allowed to talk to the World Health Organization, which is coordinating the effort.
And that is still preventing a full response to an Ebola outbreak that has now exposed more than 250 people in Uganda.
And it's not just Ebola. Stéphane Dulapré was a contract worker at USAID, but was furloughed about 10 days ago.
We have dengue fever happening. We have Mpox happening. We are in a slurry of multi-infectious disease outbreaks around our globe.
The big concern is people who aren't getting treatment for those diseases, says Angie Garvey, another USAID contractor who was also let go last week.
People are going to die. People are already dying. Life-saving work is done at USAID.
Garvey says COVID taught us that diseases don't respect borders. The State Department didn't respond to a request for comment by deadline. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace. Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, aiming to help save time by offering smart business buying solutions so there's more time to focus on growing the business and less time doing the admin. More at AmazonBusiness.com. And by The Economist, devoted to providing independent journalism that makes sense of the news shaping the world. More at economist.com or with The Economist app, newsletters, and podcasts.
Climate change is driving up business insurance for firms in the path of increasingly hot fires, but also for places that depend on cold. Insurance premiums for ski resorts and other outdoor recreational places are up more than 150% in a decade, according to an industry association. From Fairlie, Vermont, Daniel Ackerman has more.
For more than a decade, John Marsden has spent his winters ice skating on the 4-mile Lake Moray skating trail here in Fairlie. He likes to come after sunset.
And you can skate in the moonlight on the lake, and it's like nothing else in this world.
The skating is the main wintertime draw for nearby Lake Moray Resort. And many of the skaters here call the trail almost spiritual. But I had to ask resort owner Mark Avery, who maintains the trail, about something decidedly not spiritual, insurance.
Ugh.
It sounds like that's been a headache.
Yes, so you know, we've been running the trail for 14 years, and never once did I think about insurance. We just went out there and plowed and watched the community just thoroughly enjoy the trail.
Avery says getting insured was never a problem, but when he needed to renew last year, his insurer called him up.
And they said, we would love to insure you, but, you know, of course there's always a but. We're not going to cover the skate trail. There's too much liability there.
These days, insurance headaches like this are common in winter recreation. Kelly Sinclair runs the Highlands Nordic Ski Center in Ontario. She says in the last 5 years,
our premiums have doubled, and we are a facility that has had zero claims.
Industry-wide, though, claims are increasing, which raises premiums for everyone. And warmer winters with less reliable snow and ice aren't the only culprits, says Scott Brandy, president of the Ski Areas of New York.
Fires, hurricanes, windstorms, all of the above have dramatically impacted what ski areas are paying.
Back at the Lake Moray Skating Trail, Mark Avery understands his business is kind of at the whims of the weather.
Climate change is real. It's increasing liability. You have to work with it and come up with a creative solution.
This year, Avery transferred ownership of the trail to the town, which has a municipal policy for ice rinks. That means the trail is up and running again. And after a long cold snap, conditions are just right. In Fairlie, Vermont, I'm Daniel Ackerman for Marketplace.
Last week, in what some see as a Sputnik moment where the U.S. realizes that another superpower is speeding ahead on technology, markets were roiled by news that DeepSeek of China has come up with a decent ChatGPT-style AI that uses way fewer resources, including fewer computer chips. Well, this morning, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that a bipartisan group of lawmakers wants to ban DeepSeek from government phones amid worry the app might get into user data. DeepSeek is the most downloaded app in the U.S. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.